Okay, let's make a start. I see we now have the post-exam attendance in the lecture theatre. I'll make sure to include lots of questions specific from today's class. Take note, guys, in the next exam. So hopefully the exam went well. I'm told that it went well. I'm sorry I wasn't here to watch you all suffer through it. But I hear it went well. And if there are questions about the exam, of course, you're welcome to go and talk to your GSI about them. If you have very specific questions about your exam, you should definitely talk to your GSI because your GSI has your exam and was, you know, responsible for the grading of your exam. But you're also welcome to come and talk to me if the questions that came up on the exam that you don't understand or just want to get clarification on, I'd be happy to do that, obviously. All of the grades for all of the work that you have done so far, including the exam, will be posted by the end of the day today. Okay? So some of them are actually already up, but they will all be up by the end of the day today. So you can then go and see exactly where you are in terms of all of the grades. And what I will do on Thursday is I will show you a distribution of the grades so you can see sort of approximately where you fall in the class and therefore where you fall approximately in terms of what final grade you might be looking at based on your work so far. Okay, so I will do that at the beginning of the class on Thursday. Any questions about those sort of logistical things? Nope. Okay, so before we get into today's class, Thursday or Friday of last week was a fairly big deal when it comes to earthquake hazards. Can anybody tell me why? Yeah. Ah. Indeed, there was a significant magnitude earthquake in Colombia, and that was obviously a big deal for Colombia. But I was actually thinking of something a little more closer to home. All the way at the back. Dear, oh dear, you guys have got to work on this a little. There was indeed a magnitude 2.7 earthquake on Friday. In fact, there were two earthquakes about 30 seconds apart from one another. How many of you felt it? Okay, so not that many of you. Huh. So magnitude 2.7, you should be able to feel. I actually wasn't here. It was in the afternoon, right? Do you know what time it was? What time was the earthquake? 9:30 in the morning or in the evening? In the morning. How many of you were awake? Well, about the same number that felt the earthquake. Okay, so that obviously was an interesting event. It was actually in a little nest of seismicity. We call when you have these little areas where there's a cluster of seismicity in one location, i.e. you have more frequent small magnitude earthquakes, we call those nests of earthquakes. And in fact, that earthquake was in what we call the Temescal nest of earthquakes beneath the Temescal park. So yes, I'm glad some of you felt it. I didn't. I wasn't here. But that actually wasn't what I was looking for. Yes? Excellent. They improved the BART system significantly, and the way that they improved it was... He didn't read the article. Does somebody else want to try? Why is the BART system better today than it was, a month ago? Yeah. They have an earthquake early warning system. And what do we know about this earthquake early warning system? Why am I quite so excited about this? Come on, work with me here. Yes. Yes, exactly. UC Berkeley Seismological Laboratory is, in fact, working on this. And, in fact, the system that BART is now using is a system that we developed with them. And, in fact, all of the data that feeds into the BART earthquake early warning system comes from us here at Berkeley. And so this is a big step forward in the U.S. because this is actually the first organization to implement an automated response to earthquake alerts. So as you will learn later in the class when we'll actually talk about earthquake early warning specifically, Japan, for example, has had an early warning system for a while, and they have various ways that they automatically respond to earthquakes. All of the trains, all of the bullet trains stop. Various manufacturing processes shut down. People get alerts on their cell phones, etc. So they're already doing that in Japan. In the US, we are behind, and this is an area that we have been pushing on at the Berkeley Seismo Lab pretty hard. And so the fact that BART is the first organization to now start an automated response to the earthquake alerts that we generate is a very exciting step forward, and so much more significant than the magnitude 2.7 that occurred in Berkeley. Okay, so I just wanted to mention that. Yes, question?
Do they pay a royalty for that?
Do they pay a royalty for it? What do you mean?
You get any...
Oh, you mean do they pay us for it? They actually, the BART is contributing to network operations. So yeah, so BART does in fact provide a sort of grant that contributes to running the seismic network, and of course the seismic network is what's providing the data. So they are contributing to the operation of the network, although a fairly small amount. Yeah. The question is, are we coming up to the anniversary of the Loma Prieta earthquake? Anybody? Yes. When is the anniversary? Does somebody want to look it up? It's either the 17th or the 18th. It's the 17th. Okay, 17th of October is the anniversary of the Loma Prieta earthquake. That's right. How many years? It was in 1989. If you can't do the math in your head, think about it. You should be able to do the math in your head. Okay, let's move on and talk about today's topic. So we're now into the middle third of the class. Okay, I've several times sort of talked about the way that the class is set up is that it's in this thirds. The middle third of the class, now we understand the effect of earthquakes and have some general sense of where earthquakes occur. The middle third is really now looking at the science, if you like. How do we know what I've told you about earthquakes, and how can we learn more about earthquakes? How can we provide earthquake early warning? All of these questions about the actual fundamental scientific, or physical rather, process of the earthquake rupture, how we detect it, how we learn about it, how we can estimate, predict what's going to happen in the future in terms of earthquake hazards. And so that's what the middle third of the class is about. And so sort of the way we're going to start this is by talking about the process that actually builds up to earthquakes. And you've seen a piece of this already when Ingrid talked about faults. She talked about elastic rebound theory, and that's the starting point. But I'm going to introduce you to some of the observations that we can make and how this tells us about the process of building up towards an earthquake. So you've seen this slide already. This is just illustrating elastic rebound theory. And again, I'd like to point out that this theory is it's a beautifully elegant theory, and it was developed by Reed as part of the Lawson report back following the 1906 earthquake. And so this has been around. Again, the San Francisco earthquake of 1906 was a turning point for earthquake science, and elastic rebound theory is one of the things that came out of that. And this is still the framework within which we understand the earthquake cycle, as we call it. Okay, so somebody asked me this question: what's the difference between elastic rebound theory and the earthquake cycle? It's basically the same thing. The earthquake cycle is obviously just the process that you go through building up to an earthquake, having an earthquake, recovering from an earthquake, building up to the next earthquake. It's an ongoing cycle. Elastic rebound theory is the same thing. And so just to recap, so that we're all on the same page, the idea is that we gradually build up to earthquakes. Stress is continuously increasing on the known faults. The ticking tectonic time bomb is the way that some people like to think about it. Every single day, we get a step closer to the big earthquake, whether I mean the big earthquake on the Hayward Fault, on the San Andreas Fault, all of the above. So every single day, the plates have moved a little further. The stress has increased a little bit, so we are closer to having the next big earthquake. So stress builds up on these tectonic plates. On an average day, the stress along the fault plane means that the fault plane is not slipping. Okay, so the fault plane only slips in the earthquake. There's an exception, we'll come to that. The fault plane only slips in the earthquake, so on the average day, the stress on the fault plane means that these two blocks of rock are connected to one another, and so as the two plates move past one another, this is the Pacific plate, this is the North American plate, as they move past one another, you get this sort of S shape in terms of the deformation at the surface. So that's shown nicely by this nice straight stone wall at the beginning, and over time it becomes S-shaped as a result of this this tectonic build-up. Just one second. And then, of course, once we get to some threshold where the friction, we exceed the frictional strength of the fault can no longer withstand this stress, and it ruptures, and of course that is the earthquake that occurs over the course of seconds, tens of seconds, a few minutes, and releases all this built-up stress that's been building up due to these tectonic forces. And then, of course, so that actually cuts the fence, as you can see here. But now the fence, you can see, is all straight because we've released all that built-up stress. So the two sections of fence are straight, but they've been cut in half. Okay, and we go back and we start all over again. So that's the earthquake cycle. That's elastic rebound theory. Yeah, question. Absolutely. So the question is, can you actually see these kind of S shapes? You can. If you go to some places where they've put out markers, there are places across the San Andreas Fault where geologists have gone out and put out markers every, 2 meters or so in a line that's perhaps 100 meters long, and you can actually see the stress associated with the fault. But you can also see it on a larger scale using various observations, and in fact, that's exactly what I'm going to show you in a few minutes. Any other questions? Okay, so that's the process that's going on. How did Reed develop this theory? What were the observations that he used to develop this theory? And then, of course, so what kind of observations can we make today to understand where we are in the earthquake cycle today? And so to do that, we need to use geodetic surveying. So this is just the process of basically developing maps, understanding where one mountain is with respect to another mountain, where one fault is with respect to another, etc. And so there are three types of geodetic surveying that we use. And this is historically, of course, we use these today as well, but we use modern technologies today. But I want to start by thinking about how this would be done half a century or a century ago. And so the first is what we call triangulation. So triangulation is the process of measuring angles, okay? And this was very important because this was one of the first really precise geodetic tools that was available to us to understand the relative motion of the Earth's surface. Okay, and so obviously here's a map of the Bay Area. There are three main peaks in the Bay Area, as you probably know. San Bruno Mountain on the peninsula. I never know how to pronounce this. So we're going to call it Mount Tam. So Mount Tam up in the Marin Headlands, and then, of course, Mount Diablo on the other side of the Berkeley Hills. So those are the three primary peaks in the Bay Area. And the process of triangulation is the process of going and standing at one of these peaks and measuring the angle between a line to the other two peaks, as shown in this little diagram. Okay, so you can kind of line up from this peak with Mount Diablo, and you can measure very precisely the angle that San Bruno Mountain makes with respect to Mount Diablo. So that's the process of triangulation. So how does this help us see the deformation of the Earth's surface? Okay, first of all, what is the deformation of the Earth's surface at this location? Yeah, the back? That side. Which is that side? Left or right? Right. The western side is moving up and to the left. The eastern side is moving down to the right, right? The overall motion, both on individual faults and also the overall plate motion that we see across this entire region, so this is the Pacific plate, this is the North American plate, series of faults along this boundary, the overall motion is right lateral strike slip, right? So if you stand here and you look across to the other side, it's moving to the right. So this side is going down with respect to this side. Okay? So that's what the motion is doing. So if that's the motion that's going on an everyday basis, just due to this plate tectonic buildup, how would we be able to observe that using triangulation? Yeah. Okay, so over time the angle changes. How's it going to change in this case? Everybody look at it and think about it. Okay, so how's it going to change? You can just call out. It's going to get smaller. Okay? So basically what's going to happen, if we think of these two mountains are essentially on the same section, right? They're both actually to the east of the San Andreas Fault, but they're then both to the west of all of these other faults, the Hayward Fault, for example. So these two, you can think of, if we think of these two as stationary, and we ask how is Mount Diablo going to move with respect to these two, Mount Diablo is going to move in this direction, right? It's going to move to the southeast. So as Mount Diablo moves to the southeast, this angle is going to get smaller. Okay? So by measuring this angle very accurately, we can see the relative motion of Mount Diablo with respect to the other peaks. And of course, what you do is you go throughout the region looking for various peaks, and you measure all these relative angles, and then using trigonometry, you can reconstruct what the relative motion has been during this time interval between which you've measured the angles. Okay, so you do this in 1900, you do this in 1910, you do this in 1920, you look at the change in the angles and you reconstruct the relative motion in those each of those decade-long periods. Okay, so that's how triangulation works. Next one is trilateration. Trilateration is the process of measuring distances. Okay, so again, with our three peaks, we measure the distances between the three peaks, and then we come back a year later, 10 years later, 100 years later, and we measure how that distance has changed. Okay, so when we measure the distance between Mount Tam and San Bruno, how is that going to change? Yeah. It should be getting closer, San Bruno and Mount Tam. Do people agree? They should be the same. Yeah. They're actually on the same block, right? So you can think of the block. So that, again, there's the overall Pacific plate and North American plate. In the Bay Area, the motion between those two plates is accommodated by this series of faults, the San Andreas Fault, the Hayward Fault, the Calaveras Fault, the Green Valley Fault, I think, if I remember correctly, is this one. And so they're accommodated by those various faults. But between these faults is basically a stable block. And so Mount Tam and San Bruno are on the same block. So they are not going to move with respect to one another. Okay? Now, what about this distance from San Bruno to Mount Diablo? How's that distance going to change? Going to get longer? What about from Mount Tam to Mount Diablo? Okay, people seem to be much more confident that this distance is going to get longer than people were. So why is that? Why are you all more comfortable with the idea that this is getting longer and this is not? You're right. You're all right. So what's happening here, right, is that because this is moving in this direction, essentially, what's happening is it's sort of rotating. So the difference, the change in this distance here is going to be relatively small. Whereas just because of the orientation of this line, the change in this distance is going to be more significant. Right? The more oblique, if we had a mountain here and a mountain here, then that change in distance would be even bigger. Right? So just because what it comes down to is that we're measuring a distance here perpendicular to the motion. So the motion is like so, and we're measuring a distance perpendicular to it. And so the change is going to be small, whereas because this is more oblique, the change is bigger. Okay, I want you to be able to understand conceptually in your mind, be able to see how these various blocks are moving, and sort of understand then what the measurement would be. That's why we're going through this. Okay? And then the last one is leveling. And leveling is simply the process of looking at vertical motions. This is a very nice example because, of course, California in the Bay Area, it's primarily strike-slip type motion. And so there's basically very little vertical motion. There's clearly some vertical motion. That's why we have the mountains, the Berkeley Hills. But it's primarily a horizontal motion, and so leveling is less important. But in other regions, such as subduction zones, where you have collisions or where you have plates separating, the vertical motions are much more important. And so leveling is the process of understanding how two points have moved in the vertical direction with respect to one another. Okay, same sort of thing really as trilateration, it's just it's in the vertical motion. Okay, so these are the kind of, this is the principles behind using geodetic techniques to understand plate motion and how we might use that to see the process of building up to an earthquake. Any questions about these? All right, so we're going to move on and look at some examples. So this is a specific example of how Reed started to understand the process of elastic rebound theory, the process of the earthquake cycle, following the San Andreas fault. It was using trilateration, where they were measuring the distances between the peaks. And so here's some real data from measured in this region from 1959 to 1970. And what they were doing is every year, so this is the data, so these are years, 1959 all the way up to 1970. And then these numbers indicate the little segments. Okay, so this top one here is number 17. This is the segment 17, right? So 17 is measuring the distance. This is showing the change in distance in centimeters along this line right here. Okay, so this is obviously crossing the San Andreas Fault. All right? Now, because of the orientation, we're measuring the distance between here and here. Are you expecting that to increase or decrease in length? I can see somebody over here saying decrease. Absolutely. It's going to decrease in length, right? Because you're measuring from this side, the eastern side of the San Andreas, sorry, I can't hold the pointer quite steady enough, from the eastern side of the San Andreas to the western side of the San Andreas. So the eastern side of the San Andreas is moving it down, the western side of the San Andreas is moving up. So the length of this line is going to decrease, and that's exactly what the data shows. So we started in 1959 at zero, and with time, the length is decreasing. It goes down to, this is a horrible scale, but down to a little less than 20 centimeters, okay, over this essentially 10-year time period. When we look at line 20 here runs from this point across to this point, and here's the data. So line 20 is increasing in length, right? The distance of line 20 is increasing in length. So how much is it increasing by? Here's some data. You just have to read it off the graph. Yeah, about 20 centimeters. So it's increasing in length about 20 centimeters over what time interval? Ten years. And so the math is pretty straightforward. What's the increase in distance per year? 2 centimeters per year. Okay? So this line 20 is increasing in length by 2 centimeters per year. Now if we look, which one is it I want to do? If we now look at line 23, okay, so this is line 20, it's line 23 parallel to line 20. So here's the data for line 23. How much is it increasing in length? Twelve centimeters over 10 years. So that's 1.2 centimeters per year. So line 23 is only going at a rate of 1.2 centimeters per year. Line 20 is going at a rate of 2 centimeters per year. So why is that? What's the difference? Tim? Right, exactly. So basically, line 20 here is crossing all of the fault systems. So down here, south of the Bay Area, there's the San Andreas, and this is the Calaveras Fault. Okay, and so Line 20 is crossing both of those faults, whereas Line 23 is not crossing the San Andreas Fault, it's only crossing the Calaveras Fault. So whatever deformation is being accommodated on the San Andreas Fault is not being seen by Line 23, but the deformation on both the Calaveras and the San Andreas Fault is being seen by Line 20. So that's why we're seeing more motion on, or more change in distance on 20 than on 23. Okay? So again, you start to make these measurements and you can start to piece together how these relative blocks are moving with respect to one another. Okay, any questions? It's a kind of important concept, so if you have questions, you should really ask. Okay, good. All right, so that's how it was done in the good old days. How do we do this today? Obviously, we use the technology that you all have in your pocket, and that is GPS. So you all know what GPS is in the context of it's what appears on My Maps on your smartphone or on Google Earth or things like that. But I want to sort of back up and talk about what's actually the origin of this information. So the GPS stands for Global Positioning System. It's actually a constellation of 24 satellites that are continuously orbiting the Earth. They're in a relatively low Earth orbit. They're not geostationary satellites, so they're actually moving with respect to the surface of the Earth, which means that any particular GPS satellite is going to appear over the horizon, come flying overhead, and then disappear off the horizon. So the satellites that you can see that your phone or any other GPS device can see at any point in time is continuously changing. Okay, but they all come from this constellation of 24 satellites. Originally, these were developed for the military, but then basically it became available to civilians in the 1980s. Interestingly, it was actually driven by the fact that some folks had figured out how to beat the coding that the military put in the signals, and so they were able to determine locations despite the fact the military was encrypting the signals, and so at that point there was no point in encrypting it anymore, and so the military made it openly available. So how does your phone or any other GPS device determine your location? Well, it uses trilateration. So what it's doing is it's measuring the distance from your phone to 3 or 4 or perhaps more, 6 satellites. And by understanding the relative distance to these satellites, which of course are moving, so it's a complicated problem to solve, but by understanding the distance to these satellites, you can determine what your location is. If you have 3 satellites, then you can determine your position on the surface of the Earth, i.e. you can determine the latitude and the longitude of your location. Once you have a 4th satellite or more satellites, you can also estimate your elevation on the surface of the Earth. Okay, and so that's what your phone does. It comes up with your location. Some apps show elevation. The ability to determine elevation is significantly lower quality than latitude and longitude, and that's just because all of the satellites are above you. The satellites are not above you. They're all off. When you have a satellite directly above you, you can do a much better job of determining your elevation. But the majority of the time, there's no satellites directly above you. They're just sort of scattered around you. So you're looking more horizontally, which is why you can do a better job of determining your location. Yeah. How did civilians access what they... I don't know the details, but I understand the principle. What the military was doing... So the way that it actually works is that the GPS, either the GPS satellites are sending time-coded signals. So you can mark. You obviously need to measure the travel time from your phone or your GPS device to the satellite, and for that you need the time code. And so the military encrypted the time code. And what people managed to figure out is that rather than using that encrypted time code, you could actually look at the phase of the signal, i.e., the oscillation of the signal, and that allowed you to beat the encryption. So that's why they then just turned the encryption off. Yeah.
Position, and are they all, you know, sort of in position relative to the Earth? Are they, like, in the same ring around the Earth?
Yeah, so each satellite has its own predefined orbit, and it stays in that orbit, but they're all moving with respect to one another. So this, you know, this is a snapshot of what the constellation looks like. 2 seconds later, it would look quite different. But they're put in orbits in such a way that you should, at all times, have a reasonably good number of satellites that's visible from any point on the surface of the Earth. The exception to that is the poles, that the poles actually do not have particularly good coverage, so it's actually much more difficult to determine your location if you're at one of the poles. Of course, there's very few people at the poles, and that's why there's a gap in the coverage. Yeah, no, they're just satellites are just continuously falling towards the Earth, right? And so they just stay in their orbit by that process. But they also do have some propulsion on them, so you can actually change the orbit of the satellite up to some point. Yeah?
Is the entire world 24 satellites made by the U.S. military?
So the question was, is the entire world using these 24 satellites used by the U.S. military? There are actually other GPS satellites, systems that are up there, and I can't remember the names of them, but they're not used as broadly. China right now, I know, is in the process of setting up another constellation of satellites to provide even more accurate information. But this particular set of satellites is what kind of is where we all started from, and it's global. I mean, it's with this exception of the poles, it's a global coverage, and so there's not really the need for an alternative. Yeah. GLOMAS, that's right. I know GLOMAS is one of the other alternatives, that's right. Okay? A lot of interest in GPS, I see. Okay, let's keep going. So, of course, what this then comes down to is that, I mean, it's, okay, so this is something that's changed, obviously, relatively recently with the development of, frankly, the iPhone, which brought GPS technology to, you know, in everybody's phones, essentially. Prior to that, you would buy this little handheld device. You still can buy them, of course. But basically, everybody's cell phone, not just smartphones now, everybody's cell phone has a GPS chip in it and so can determine its location. So these are the very simple handheld devices. The point here is, and what's important to remember, is that these have an accuracy of several meters. Okay? If you have not, if you're not just using like the Google Maps app or whatever the new one is, the Apple Maps app, then that just shows your location. Although you do see an uncertainty, right? You see an uncertainty circle. If you use one of the other sort of purpose-built GPS apps, it will tell you what the uncertainty in your location is. And you'll see that the uncertainty in your location, best scenario, is several meters. Okay? Having an accuracy of several meters is completely worthless when it comes to looking at tectonic plate motions, right? What's the plate motion of the Pacific with respect to North America? What's a typical plate motion velocity? Yeah? 15 millimeters per year. That's a reasonable. So typically plate motions are up to, the fastest plate motion is about 9 centimeters per year. Actually, that's not the fastest, but that's one of the faster ones. Typically a few centimeters per year. So if we only have an accuracy of several meters, then obviously we're not going to be able to measure plate motion with a rate of a few centimeters per year. Okay? So we need something that's more accurate. And so what we do, and I think Ingrid talked about this briefly, is we use what's called differential GPS. These are much higher precision antennas. This little disc on this tripod is the GPS antenna. Records the signals with much higher accuracy, and then we use multiple of these to understand the relative positions of two antennas or more antennas, and that allows us to get down to accuracy of a few millimeters. And so by making these measurements over the course of a year, we can actually see plate tectonic motion. So that's how we can actually observe the plates moving today, okay, using this differential GPS. And so Ingrid showed you this example that comes from the Berkeley Stadium, where they put out 4 GPS receivers on the 4 corners of the stadium. And then this figure that you've seen at least twice before shows the relative motion of these stations with respect to this this station number C here. You can see that station A and B is moving to the lower right of this diagram, to the southeast. So this is the right lateral motion on the Hayward Fault. And of course, this is the creep on the Hayward Fault. So before I didn't mention creep, as you know, we do have creep on some faults. And so what we're seeing here is very rapid motion across a fault plane, and that's because of the creep. But as you also know, the creep on the Hayward Fault is 4 millimeters per year. That's less than half of the long-term slip rate. So we're accumulating strain on the Hayward Fault at the rate of 6 millimeters per year. So that's the process of building up to the next big earthquake on the Hayward Fault. The creep is not accommodating all of the motion. Okay? So what does this look like? I started with that picture for the elastic rebound theory, and I showed you this idea that you have this S shape. So when we actually look at these GPS positions, do we see that S shape? Somebody asked whether we see this earlier. And so this is turned on its side. You've seen this figure before, but orange juice, of course. This is San Francisco here. This is Berkeley over here. So this is just turned on its side. North is going in this direction. And if you look at this section, sort of across the fault system, San Andreas, Rogers Creek Fault, you can see that down here, the slip out vectors, or the motion vectors, sorry, are moving to the left. And as you go up this transect, they get smaller and smaller and smaller. They become basically zero right here. And then as you keep going further along the section, they become bigger and bigger, but now moving to the right. So this is that S-shaped curve that I was talking about on that very first slide. So we can see the S-shaped curve across the San Andreas fault system just north of the Bay Area. And what that indicates is that the faults here are locked. There is no creep on the Rogers Creek fault, no creep on the northern San Andreas fault. And that contrasts with our section of the Hayward fault. It's difficult to see, I know, but our section of the Hayward fault does have 4 millimeters of creep per year, as we know. And so the way that you see that is here, these vectors are essentially zero. You go across the fault and they immediately become this size, which corresponds to 4 millimeters per year relative to here. Okay, the other thing I should have said at the beginning is that all of these vectors are being plotted with respect to this station here, Lutz. Okay, so when we see that at this station, for example, it's moving to the left, it means it's moving to the left with respect to Lutz, whereas this station is moving to the right with respect to Lutz. Okay? So whenever you're plotting GPS motions, they're always with respect to another location, and that's because we're using this differential GPS approach. Any questions? All right. So let's expand out a little bit. So this is just showing specifically across the Bay Area. Okay? So relatively narrow cross-section. If we expand out, so this is a map on the scale of California and Nevada, as you can see. And all of these blue dots here are places where GPS motions are being observed. Most of these are what's called campaign GPS. So what people do is they have markers on the ground in concrete pillars on the ground, and they come back every year and they measure the relative location of all of these locations, and they've been doing this for several decades now. And so we can then reconstruct the relative motion of all of these points with respect to one another. Okay? And so this is zooming into a cross-section or a line of these markers across the Bay Area. And it's now showing the motion relative to the center of North America. So imagine that the center of North America is fixed, and we're now showing how all of these other points are moving with respect to the center of North America. Okay? So, of course, the station that is closest to our fixed point, this station here, UCD, this is the one that has the smallest arrow. And as you get further and further away, and you go across the plate boundary and onto the Pacific plate, this station FARB, this is the one that's furthest from our stationary point, across the plate boundary, and so this has the largest vector. Okay? And so here's the scale bar. 20 millimeters per year. So what's the length of this arrow approximately? Come on, very straightforward. Just have to engage brain. Say again? 60 millimeters, 50, 60 millimeters, right? So the length of this arrow is 20 millimeters per year. So the length of this arrow is actually 50 millimeters per year, okay? And so this is how we can make this statement, that the total motion across the North America Pacific plate boundary is 5 centimeters per year. Okay, so the Pacific is moving up in this direction at 5 centimeters per year with respect to North America. All right, so we can now go and calculate rates of motion for objects that are on the Pacific plate relative to the North America plate. And you all know how much I like to talk about Los Angeles. So let's talk about Los Angeles. So Los Angeles, the whole city of Los Angeles is actually on the Pacific plate, right? Because it's all to the southwest of the San Andreas Fault. So Los Angeles is on the Pacific plate. San Francisco, you know that the San Andreas Fault runs up here, right? This is the San Andreas Fault right here. So the city of San Francisco is on the North American plate. So now that we know that the relative motion across this plate boundary is 5 centimeters per year, the distance between Los Angeles and San Francisco is about 500 kilometers, excuse me. So how long does it take to go 500 kilometers at the rate of 5 centimeters per year? It takes 10 million years. So I showed you that little video when we were talking about plate tectonics. So Los Angeles is moving with the Pacific plate up in this direction relative to San Francisco. And so it's in about 10 million years, Los Angeles will be at the same latitude as San Francisco. What happens next? It keeps going. Yeah, so Los Angeles, if we think of North America as being fixed, and Los Angeles is on the Pacific plate, so it keeps going. So what's going to happen as it goes up here? When you think about plate tectonics, what's up to the north?
Alaska.
And what's the plate boundary around Alaska? Subduction zone. So what happens to Los Angeles? 60 million years, Los Angeles disappears down the Aleutian Arc, down the subduction zone. I'm not kidding. Okay, let's move on. So that's GPS, what you do with GPS. Okay? So the other important technology that we use today to understand relative motions at the surface of the Earth is synthetic aperture radar. Okay? So synthetic aperture radar is essentially you use a satellite, or you can also use a plane, or in fact the space shuttle was used for this as well. And you just fire a beam of a radar down from the satellite to the surface of the Earth. It bounces off the surface of the Earth and comes back to the satellite, and you record the amount of time it's taken to bounce off the surface of the Earth. Okay? So if you measure the time it takes to bounce a radar signal off the surface of the Earth and come back, you can convert that into a distance, right? All right, so you can measure the distance from your satellite, from your space shuttle, from your plane to the surface of the Earth. So that's what SAR is, synthetic aperture radar. Okay, what we actually use for Earth solid Earth studies is INSAR, interferometric synthetic aperture radar. And what this is it's about looking at the difference. The interferometric part is about looking at the difference between radar signals between one point in time and some later time. So the idea is you have these INSAR satellites that are going over the surface of the Earth continuously, and periodically they come back and they're looking at the same surface of the point on the surface of the Earth, typically a month apart. And you can then look at how the distance to the surface of the Earth has changed over the course of that month. So that's the idea behind INSAR. All right, we're continually monitoring the position of the surface of the Earth, and we can see how it's changed between these orbits. And so this is kind of how it works, is sort of shown down here. So here's a fault, okay, and so the green and the red are two successive passes of the satellite. So the green one is before an earthquake on this fault, right? So this is a thrust fault. So as a result of this fault, this block here has been pushed up, which means the surface of the Earth here is now closer to the satellite than it was beforehand. So before the earthquake, it's the green signal, and the surface of the Earth would be right about here. After the earthquake, this has been pushed up, and the distance from the satellite to the surface of the Earth has been reduced. And we can actually measure that distance. That's what INSAR is about. Very accurate. The wavelength of the INSAR is 2.8 centimeters, and so we can be measuring distances with an accuracy much less than 2.8 centimeters. So how do we apply this? Here's an application of it to the Bay Area. So let me orient you a little bit. This is San Francisco. This is the peninsula, San Francisco. This is the Bay. This is the East Bay. The red line here is the Hayward Fault. And then all this blue stuff is on the eastern side of the Hayward Fault. And so this is an INSAR image for the Bay Area. I forget the time interval, actually, over which that this was being measured. But what's being shown by the color is the rate, the change in the range. So the change in the distance from the satellite to the surface of the Earth between two successive passes. And the red color here represents a change in the range of plus 4.5 millimeters per year. And the blue is a change in range of minus 4.5 millimeters per year. Okay? So across the Hayward Fault, we're seeing a total change in the range of 9 millimeters per year. Okay? So this is, remember, on the Hayward Fault, we know that we have a creep rate of 4 millimeters per year. All right, so that's the change in the range going from here to here. There's about 4 millimeters per year. All right, but then across this entire region from the Pacific coastline to as far east as we're seeing with this is a change in range of 9 millimeters per year. Now, there's one caveat here. And this is a change in range, and the satellite is not looking horizontal. So this isn't a horizontal distance. This is a change in the distance along the path that the radar is looking. And the radar is looking down at the surface of the Earth at about 45 degrees. Okay? So if we want to convert this to an actual horizontal distance, we have to do some very simple trigonometry. So we're measuring a range change of 9 millimeters per year across this entire region. So in the path that the satellite's looking. So here's the path the satellite's looking. It's at 45 degrees to the surface of the Earth. This is the surface of the Earth. This is the direction that we're looking at. 9 millimeters per year in this orientation, 45 degrees. Some simple trigonometry. That translates into 6 millimeters per year in the horizontal direction. Okay? So we know that the creep rate on the Hayward Fault in the Berkeley area is about 4 millimeters per year. What we're seeing here is a total of 6 millimeters per year across that region. So 4 millimeters per year of this is the creep rate on the Hayward Fault. The other 2 millimeters per year is this tectonic buildup. Okay? And it's 2 millimeters per year. We're not seeing the full 5 centimeters per year because we're only looking across a section of this region. We're not looking across the whole plate boundary region. So that's why it's less than 5 centimeters per year. Okay? So this is how we use INSAR. I sort of skipped over. The point here, the difference between INSAR and GPS is that we can get a relative motion at any point that reflects the radar energy back up to the surface. So this is more powerful than GPS because you can do it as a map over the surface of the Earth. You only have GPS at these specific locations where we've put GPS stations. The catch is that we can't do it everywhere. We don't get reflections from water surface, so the bay has nothing. We're not getting good reflections down here. This is because this is vegetated regions. The places that we're getting good reflections from are actually urban areas. And what it is, it's actually the corners of houses or buildings. So those corners of buildings are great reflectors for radar. And of course, they stay fixed. So you come back a few months later, you get the same reflection off the same corner of a building. And that's how we get this observation. Okay, so that's INSAR. So now we have GPS and we have INSAR. Any questions about INSAR? Okay, so a couple of examples of how we actually use INSAR. So this is, first of all, an example from a volcano. All right, it's a little different. But this is a typical sort of image of how we use INSAR. We show what are called fringes. So each of these fringes where you go from yellow through red, blue, green, back to yellow, red, blue, green, yellow, red, blue, green, yellow. Each of those cycles represents one wavelength. So I told you that the radar has a wavelength of 2.8 centimeters. So each of these fringes, each of these cycles of color represents a range change of 2.8 centimeters. again in the direction of the satellite. Okay, so we can start to kind of measure these distances just by counting the fringes. Okay, so how many fringes are there here? Yep. Yeah, there's sort of three or four, depending on how you count. So the total change in range at the center of this image compared to the edges is either 3 or 4 times 2.8 centimeters. Okay? And so what this is telling us is that the range change is you just multiply the 2.8 by the number of fringes, and that tells us what you've had, and it's about 10 centimeters of uplift. In this particular image is from a period of 1996 to 2001, and it has 10 centimeters of uplift. So we can see the deformation of the surface of this volcano. So this is a volcano, so what's the process that's responsible for this? Well, it's the process of filling a magma chamber. As you gradually fill the magma chamber beneath the volcano, it causes uplift of the surface of the Earth. And then, of course, you would get subsidence by one of two processes. One possibility is a volcanic eruption, and the other possibility is that you empty the magma chamber in some other way, such as the magma flowing out laterally and you know, staying below the surface. And so we're still waiting to see what happens. This uplift occurred. There was a little more uplift after 2001, but then it stopped, and it's not moved since. So it's still unclear what the final outcome of this uplift will be. One last example that I want to show you. And this is from the Landers earthquake. So the Landers earthquake was a magnitude 7 earthquake in Southern California. And it caused significant surface deformation. Here's a photo just showing the deformation of one of the roads. This is in the Mojave Desert, east of Los Angeles. And this is, again, an INSAR image from the Landers earthquake. Okay, and so this is where the fault is. So again, the way you do this is you start as far away from the fault as possible and you count the fringes into the fault, and that tells you something about the change in the distance, which is the slip on the fault. Okay, so how many fringes are we seeing here? So the way you do this is you sort of start on the outside. The way to do this is, because we don't have much information on this side of the fault, you want to do it on this side of the fault. You want to start somewhere on the outside. You come into the image, you pick a color, and then you count how many times you see that color. So call out what you've counted. 7, 8, 9. Yeah, I mean, it's sort of, again, of course, you can do this in much more detail, but we want a sort of, estimate of what's the total displacement. So 8 is the average. I just heard 7, 8, and 9. So a total of 8 fringes, 2.8 centimeters per year. So that's a range change of about 20 centimeters, right? And so you multiply that by the 45-degree rule, and you get down to, 13 centimeters, something like that. And so we can immediately see that this area up here, this area here has moved about 13 centimeters in a horizontal direction relative to the edges of this image. Okay, so that's telling you something about the surface displacement. We can obviously see that there's more than that at this particular location. So what we're not capturing is where we lose the coherency close to the fault. We're losing the coherency. You can't count these fringes anymore. So the slip is obviously quite a bit bigger. But just based on these fringes, you can see about 13 centimeters of deformation, i.e., this point right here has moved 13 centimeters with respect to this point right here. Okay? I think I'm going to stop there. The rest of the lecture, so take a look at the lecture notes. The rest of the lecture is talking about fluids and earthquakes. It's a slightly different topic, so I'm just going to stop here, and we'll continue on Thursday.